On February 3rd, 1959, American rock and roll musicians Buddy Holly, Ritchie Valens, and J.P. the Big Bopper Richardson were killed in a plane crash near Clear Lake, Iowa, together with the pilot Roger Peterson. The event later became known as the Day the Music Died, after singer-songwriter Don McLean referred to it as his song American Pie that you're hearing right now. At the time, Holly and his band consisted of Waylon Jennings, Tommy Alsup, and Carl Bunch. They were playing on the Winter Dance Party Tour across the Midwest. Rising artists Valens, Richardson, and Dion in the Belmonts had joined the tour as well. The long journeys between venues on board the cold, uncomfortable tour buses adversely affected the performers. Cases of flu and even frostbite. After stopping at Clear Lake to perform and frustrated by such conditions, Buddy Holly chose to charter a plane to reach their next venue in Moorhead, Minnesota. Richardson, who had the flu, swapped places with Jennings, taking his seat on the plane, while Alsup lost his seat to Valens on a coin toss. Soon after takeoff, late at night and in the poor wintry weather conditions, the pilot apparently lost control of the light aircraft, the Beechcraft Bonanza, which subsequently crashed into a cornfield. Everyone on board was killed. But there's still a controversy about that crash. And in a moment, Gary Moore, who probably knows more about this case than anybody, joins us on Coast to Coast AM. We will be right back. And welcome back to Coast. Let me tell you about Gary Moore. Gary is the author of the critically acclaimed book, Playing with the Enemy, winner of the 2006 Military Writers Society of America Book of the Year Award. Playing with the Enemy is currently optioned as a major motion picture. Gary is a contributing author for Chicken Soup for the Father and Son Soul and a self-syndicated columnist. With a degree in music education from Vandercook, Gary has performed professionally music of all genres and taught students of all ages and groups, and will often mix his percussive performance skills into the subject matter at hand. Gary, welcome to the program, and welcome back, I should say.
George, thank you so much. It's a pleasure to be on, and it's great to be on with you. I've been a fan.
I had a chance to interview Kenny Aronoff about a year ago, the great drummer. And, God, he's exciting. He wrote a book. And he's one of a kind, one of a kind. You must know all kinds of musicians, too, huh?
I do. It's been a kind of real pleasure most of my life. I've been able to be around some of the great ones. You know, for me, the greatest drummer ever was Buddy Rich.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Well, every time I hear that song, American Pie,
yes,
I think of this tragedy, this incredible story. How did you get interested in it?
You know, I was never a Buddy Holly fan. It's just the strangest thing, the way I was drawn into this. My mother-in-law, who is just the kindest, most wonderful woman you'd ever meet, lived in Iowa, grew up in Waterloo. She, for her 75th birthday, said she wanted to go to the reenactment of the Winter Dance Party. Well, I thought the Winter Dance Party, knowing her age, must have been ballroom dancing, something like that, and thought I should take some dance lessons. But later found out that she was just a rabid Buddy Holly fan, and I didn't know it. And so we went to the reenactment. It was a performer by the name of John Mueller, who travels with the show.
Mm-hmm.
He owns the rights now to the Winter Dance Party. And, you know, I sat through the evening, and it was great music and, you know, wonderfully performed. The Big Bopper was performed by the Big Bopper's real-life son, and it was great and emotional, and the performer that did Ritchie Valens was outstanding. And John Mueller came out as Buddy Holly, and it was great, but nothing really tripped my trigger, excited me, till at the very end of the show, John announced that he was about to sing a song called Hey Buddy that he had written.
Uh-huh.
And my first thought was, you know, are you going to ruin a beautiful night and interject something that you've written? And the song was so haunting and captivating. When it ended, my wife looked over at me, and she saw a tear running down my face. She said, "What happened? What's wrong?" And I said, "I don't know." And, you know, from that moment on, I was just almost on an obsession to learn more about Buddy Holly, learn more about... And I determined that I wasn't going to write about the crash. I thought there's enough written about that. I just want to write about you know, who Buddy Holly was, try to find stories that people hadn't written about. But I ended up speaking to Barb Dwyer, who was the wife of Jerry Dwyer, the man who owned the charter service. And one sentence that she said to me drew me to the crash and in my analysis of it.
I've got to tell you, it was an incredible story. I was only 9 when this thing all happened, so I was way too young to really understand it. But
right.
Later on, I began to realize, you know, this was a huge story. And I've seen pictures of the plane. It is so mangled.
Yes.
It's a wonder they all died, because there's nothing left of this plane. And was it the Big Bopper? Was he the one who was, like, tossed 30 feet away from everybody else?
Yeah, actually 40 feet. He was 40 feet ahead of the plane. And very scantily dressed. Most of his clothes had been removed, which seems shocking that he would be so far away and be undressed. But crash investigators will tell you that it's not unusual. And I actually worked with a crash investigator from the NTSB as we kind of recreated the crash. And he said that's not surprising at all.
Didn't they also find a handgun somewhere?
They did. They did. They didn't find the handgun until the spring. You know, it had snowed. It was snowing when the crash occurred, and it snowed throughout the night. So as investigators, you know, arrived, the plane in the area was snow-covered. And when they did the crash cleanup, they didn't get all the debris. Well, farmer by the last name of Jewell was plowing the field in the spring, saw a handgun. So he got out of his tractor, picked up the gun, looked at it, and for whatever reason did the dumbest thing you should do. He pointed it up in the air, pulled the trigger, and it went off.
And it went off.
And so he...
Evidence.
Yeah. And so he thought, well, okay, I'll take this to the sheriff the next day, and he did. And the sheriff looked at it, and they found out from the serial number that it was registered to Charles Hardin Holly, which is Buddy's real name. And and he recorded in the notes that it had been one shell fired.
Beyond what he fired?
No, just one.
Just one.
Just one. But he did not make a note that it was fired by the farmer. And so a few years later, the newspapers got a hold of it.
Made it sound like something happened in the plane.
Made it happen like something. Well, not only that. A photographer claimed that when he was taking pictures of the crash, that he found a bullet hole in the back of the pilot seat, and it just became almost standard rock and roll wisdom at the time that Buddy had shot the pilot.
Are you convinced at this point, Gary, that what happened was pilot's error?
I am convinced it's pilot's error. Yes. It's you know, first of all, I'm a pilot, and I was also I spent 6 years of my life as a charter operator, and so a lot of experience with pilots, a lot of experience in airplanes, and it is so crystal clear really what happened. You have a 21-year-old pilot who was not instrument rated,
and the weather was lousy.
Weather was awful. It was just awful.
They should never have flown that day.
No, that's exactly right, and it's amazing. I actually received hate mail and threatening mail.
Why?
Well, I took the position in my book as we kind of wrote this analysis that
the one called "Hey Buddy."
Yeah, that exactly. Book. And that it was pilot error, and we lay out the exact, you know, every scenario of the crash, what happened, and. Through the years, there has become a very strong, I guess, lobby, I'd call it, for Jerry Dwyer. Jerry is the charter operator. And Jerry had spun, before he passed away, he'd spun out different theories to kind of make, I guess, excuses for the fact that he let that plane take off.
Right. He wanted to kind of take the load off himself.
Yeah. And so, you know, when he wrote the crash analysis, it obviously points to the fact that Jerry was the adult in the room. He owned the airplane. He employed the pilot. Yet he put a 21-year-old unqualified, inexperienced pilot who had a record of suffering from vertigo in the pilot seat of an overloaded Bonanza, which was having a lot of problems at the time, and the crash lasted 5 minutes. My analysis was everybody was surprised that the plane crashed. I would be surprised if it didn't.
Yeah, that it even took off.
Oh, absolutely, absolutely. It's just it is a tragedy upon tragedy, and the greatest tragedy is the fact that the operator actually let the plane go. And you know, George, he knew, because the flight left shortly after midnight. And he's a charter operator. He spent the whole day with the pilot, checking the weather, checking the plane. He stayed, and it was record cold. It was, by most accounts, the wind chill was almost 30 below. And he stayed out there with the plane, loaded the plane. Once the plane taxied off, he didn't leave and go home. He went up to an observation area outside, watched the plane take off, and stood there until the plane was out of sight, then went to the control tower and tried to contact the plane. And in all my years of operating a charter service, I never did that. You know, I had qualified pilots. If I was at the airport, I'd help load the plane, see it off, that kind of thing. But, it was his action says that he was worried, that he was concerned. And, before Jerry Dwyer got home and got to bed that night, that plane was dead, was crashed. The inhabitants of the plane were dead and cold already out there in the snow.
Why so many conspiracy theories, Gary, about the crash?
Well, better than anyone that certainly there are conspiracy theories of almost everything.
Yes, anytime at any time.
Yeah, anytime that we have people of prominence, our heroes especially, if they die a tragic but explainable death, there's something encoded in our DNA that just doesn't want to believe that, want to accept that.
Jim Morrison, still alive, things like that.
Absolutely, absolutely. In fact, I was just kind of going through the book. I wrote the book almost 10 years ago, so I was going through my notes this afternoon, and I was surprised, as I remembered so many of the theories that I never put into the book. But one of them that's floating out there now, and it's all over the Internet, is that the crash was faked. The buddy didn't like his life and reappeared a few years later as somebody else.
That's interesting. Also, there was a theory about a bomb, right, put in the plane?
Yeah, there was a...
Why would that pop up?
Well, it is a fact that during that early time of rock and roll, the organized crime, mafia, La Cosa Nostra, whatever you want to call it, they were really working hard to take over the recording industry, and these artists were, almost all of them were teenagers. They didn't know better. They were signing contracts they shouldn't have signed, signed their life away. And they were pursuing Buddy pretty hard.
The mob
Buddy was resisting. And Peggy Sue Gernon, who is the famed Peggy Sue of the two song, hit songs.
Peggy Buddy Sue, yep, that's right.
Yeah, longtime Buddy.
Our friend Gary Busey played the Buddy Holly in the Buddy Holly story in 78, by the way.
Yeah, absolutely.
I remember him singing that song.
And did an incredible job.
Yeah, he did. He really did.
Just did an incredible job. But Peggy Sue said that Buddy had called her and talked to her about the fact that he was afraid. Said they were following the bus. They were threatening him.
Jeez.
And it's a plausible theory. But George, the thing that makes it very difficult to believe that that's a first of all, there was no.
Well, I got to tell you, the wreckage looks like it got blown up.
Well,
I've never seen a plane more mangled in all my life.
Oh yeah, it ended up just being a ball of aluminum and wire. But the crash investigators we work with said, there was absolutely no evidence of a bomb. And the plane, if the plane had, there had been a bomb on board, the plane would have blown apart in the air in the crash site.
And pieces would have been everywhere.
It would have been everywhere. Yeah. And this was a very tight crash site. And the plane was almost totally in contact and together, but mangled.
Mangled. That's right.
Yeah.
Exactly. It doesn't look like a plane.
No, you would not know it as an airplane. In fact, I'll tell you a story.
Where were the bodies? In the rubble?
The only body that was in the rubble was the pilot. In fact, they were looking for the pilot, and they found the plane around 9 o'clock in the morning, a little bit earlier.
Not far from the runway, right?
No, 5 miles.
Yeah.
5 miles out in the cornfield in Mason City, Iowa. And when the investigators arrived, they found Buddy and Polly and Richie Valens were maybe 15 feet, 10 feet from the airplane.
Mangled, no doubt.
And, oh, terribly mangled. In fact, I talked to, had the pleasure just about 6 months ago, I got a phone call from the priest who was called to the site.
Jeez.
And had a conversation with him, and he just said that it was something he wished he wouldn't have seen.
It was just
awful, and stuck in his head all these years. And then the Big Bopper was 40 feet out in front of the site, had been, but they couldn't find the pilot, and they were searching, scouring the field, looking everywhere for the pilot. And it wasn't until almost noon they realized he was rolled up in that ball of aluminum,
all scrunched up.
Yeah.
Ugh.
Yeah.
Ugh. Well, no wonder these conspiracy theories are popping up all over the place.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, they were teen idols at the time, and there had never been anything in our memory quite like rock and roll, the way it had captivated and seized the imagination of the young at the time. And they just it was such a shocking death. It just couldn't be accepted. And so the mind goes to work. I mean, there are some real strange issues that are unexplainable involving this crash and the death and their lives and so on and so forth. But the crash was, it's a very classic. In fact, if you want to look at the NTSB analysis of John Kennedy Jr. crash, it's almost textbook exactly the same way.
A pilot without proper training.
Yeah.
That kind of thing.
Yeah, it was they lost his horizon. Vertigo set in. When you're in a single engine plane, it has a natural tendency to roll to the right because the engine is spinning at this incredible torque. And if you don't have the plane trimmed correctly, if you're not visually in control, you will not feel it slowly start turning. Well, once it starts turning to the right, it will start
dive,
spiral.
Right? Goes into some kind of dive.
Well, it goes into a spiral and it'll start diving. Well, you don't realize you're turned up on its side, and the natural tendency for any pilot is if they think they're going to crash, they pull back on the yoke. Well, if you're on your side, all that does is tighten the spiral. And what we know from the instruments were locked in at the moment of impact, where they were going 170 miles per hour when they hit the ground. They were dropping at about 3,000 feet per minute, which isn't a straight down crash. I mean, they were spiraling around. The plane hit on the right wing and started spinning and cartwheeling, which is what created that ball of aluminum when it finally came to rest against the fence.
The day the music died. We're going to come back in a moment, Gary, and talk more about the cases, the various cases, and we'll take phone calls with you next hour. Gary W. Moore with us. His websites are linked up at coasttocoastam.com. His latest book is called Hey Buddy, In Pursuit of Buddy Holly, My New Buddy John, and My Lost Decade of Music. It's an amazing story, and we'll be back in a moment. And welcome back to Coast to Coast. We're back with Gary Moore as we talk about his work, Hey Buddy, and The Day the Music Died. Now, there's always been a rumor that there was a fight on board as well. Does that have to do with the gun, Gary?
Yeah, I think it does. That is a rumor that was started by Jerry Dwyer, the charter operator. He said that there was an argument going on as he was loading the plane, and so that's why it crashed. He said Buddy had a gun, Buddy shot the pilot. It just became bizarre and unbelievable.
Was he alleging the shooting was done on purpose?
Yes. Yeah.
Jeez.
Yeah, he was
saying
like
a suicide mission.
Yeah, well, Buddy would have to be mentally ill or suicidal because he shot the only person who knew how to fly the plane.
Yeah, right. Nobody else was a pilot.
But the autopsy shows no bullet holes. All of the bullets were accounted for in the gun. So it's really silliness. It's just, it just didn't happen.
the incredible story about things that were created after the fact continued to grow. I mean, you came across some bizarre things yourself, didn't you?
Oh, I have. And, you know, George, I've always loved your show. My sons are just, they're crazy about your show.
Tell them how I feel.
Really miss it. But I've always been a guy who is not a conspiracy theorist. You know, I think there's a logical explanation to everything.
Sure.
But after writing this book, I finished the manuscript, and it was not yet published. And the strangest thing in my life happened. My wife and I are laying in bed one night, and we have a TV that's up in an alcove above the bed. And I woke up about 1 o'clock in the morning, and there was this blue light shining behind the TV. And I'm, you know, half awake and half asleep, and I'm thinking, well, that's a TV. I guess it's not unusual, but that TV's been there for 10 years. I've never noticed it.
Mm-hmm.
I got up and turned on the light. Of course, the blue light disappeared. My wife asked me what was going on, and I said, there's a blue light up there. So we shut it off, and she said, what's that? And I said, I don't know. Well, we went to sleep. About 3 days later, and this is before the book is published. The book is getting ready to be published, but there's no advance press on it. Nobody has seen the book yet.
So it's going to be a quiet release. Huh?
Yeah. And I get a phone call on my cell phone, and it was a woman who identified herself. She's from Pittsburgh, and she identified herself as a medium. And she said, and if you understand my personality, you'd know what a shock to the system this would be of me and how disbelieving I'd be. She said, Buddy's trying to reach you. Why won't you speak to him?
Jeez, yeah.
And I said, well, Buddy who? She says, well, Buddy Holly. And I thought it had to be a joke. You know, I said, well, what do you mean, Buddy Holly? She said, well, he's trying to reach you, and you won't speak to him. Well, we talked a little bit. I kind of brushed it off, and I thought, well, this is a crazy woman. Later on, the book tour launches. Book's getting great reviews. I'm out on tour, and I end up in Lubbock, Texas, for a book signing at the Buddy Holly Center, which is the home of Buddy Holly.
Home of Buddy, that's right.
Yeah, I'm laying in bed, and in a hotel, days in, I think it is, and I look up, and there's this blue light. It's a perfect blue circle. It's behind the TV. It's kind of glowing. I do the same routine, get up, turn on the light. The light disappears. I turn the TV around. I'm looking. I'm trying to figure out what it is. Turn off the light. It's there the rest of the night. But something strange happened is it shifted from behind the TV and moved next to the TV. Again, you know.
Is it like an orb?
Exactly. It's a perfect blue orb. And so a few days later, I get a call from this medium again. And she's again telling me. And she starts crying. She says, I don't know what to do to get through to you. He's trying to talk to you. And I said, okay. I said, let's assume that I believe this.
Let's talk.
I said, how would Buddy be trying to talk? How would he contact me? And she said he would appear as a blue orb.
Oh,
and
now that got you.
Oh, it just you know, blew my mind, so to speak, and I couldn't believe it. Well, then I became fascinated, and I started reading about, you know, this kind of thing, and you know, I never saw it again. I never had a conversation with Buddy other than in my mind and in my heart, but it was just the most unusual thing. And then I got a phone call from. Shortly after the book came out, I got a phone call, and it was a man who's crying, and he's speaking what appears to be Italian to me. I don't speak Italian, but it's pretty sure it was
mm-hmm.
Italian. And he's just kind of ranting and saying the same things over and over, and he's crying, and I didn't understand him. Finally, there was this kind of a wrestle for the phone. I can hear on the other end, and a guy with broken English said, this is my friend, and he says, his name is Adolfo, and... he has to talk to you. He said, do you speak Italian? I said, no. He said, well, let me try to interpret. Well, Adolfo was born in February of 1959, and he says that from his earliest memory, he would have these reoccurring dreams of spinning, being sick, people screaming, people being frantic, being afraid. He said then he would wake up, and he would wake up in a sweat. And he said, this has gone over and over and over and over again. And he wasn't a Buddy Holly fan, didn't know anything about Buddy Holly. He said, but he had read an account of my book about the crash, realized the crash happened on his birthday. And in there, I'm talking, in the book, I do talk about the fact that The last 3 minutes of that flight had to be absolutely frightening because everybody knew that plane was out of control.
It was dark. It was horrible.
They're in the dark. They're spinning. People are screaming. I mean, you can just imagine what it would be like. And Adolfo was describing exactly that.
Oh. He was living the crash.
He was living the crash. I mean, I have trouble accepting those types of things. But I don't know how else to explain it.
When you wrote the book, did you have any endorsements by people who knew them or the family?
You know, I tried to find people who had never been interviewed but knew Buddy intimately. His backup singers, different people who had Bobby V, who really launched his career because Buddy died. He ended up taking Buddy's place the next night on the tour. And in getting information from them, and it paints a different picture of a Buddy Holly that most people think about, and that was absolutely fascinating. And I would have loved to have had a conversation with that blue orb, but I don't think that my mind or my heart was accepting of it at that point.
Would it be now?
Absolutely.
Come back, Buddy. Come back, right?
Yeah.
What about the luck of Waylon Jennings and Tommy Alsup?
Yeah.
They should have been on those planes, on that plane.
They should have been on the plane. And
Richie Valens should have been alive.
Richie Valens should have been alive. I mean, Richie was begging for a seat. Buddy had booked the airplane for him, Tommy, and Waylon.
Mm-hmm.
They had been on this tour. It was freezing. Carl Bunch, the drummer, had frostbite, was in the hospital, and I think it was in Green Bay, Wisconsin. They left him behind, and Buddy just had it, so he chartered a plane. And Waylon said he'd never been in a plane. He was afraid of pilot flying.
He didn't really want to go.
He didn't want to go, and he said the Big Bopper came up to him and said, "Look, I've got the flu." He said, "I'd like to get there early and see if I can get a shot," and Waylon gave up his seat. And then Richie was begging Tommy to get on the plane, and Tommy didn't want to give up a seat. And finally he says, "Okay, we'll flip a coin for it." And people say that Richie won the coin toss. I think in retrospect,
he lost it. Yeah, he lost it.
And so he was killed.
Waylon died eventually in 2002. Tommy Alsup died in 2017.
Yes, he just died a year and a half.
Did they ever talk publicly about this?
Oh, they did. You know, Waylon actually wrote and recorded two songs that mentioned Buddy. He didn't talk about it much until the very end. Just a few months before he died, he gave an interview on WGN radio.
Chicago, yeah.
And I was on the show a few years after Waylon had died, talking about this book, same show. And the host said, it was just the strangest thing. He said he became very emotional, and he told a story he'd never told before. And what the story was he was close friends with Buddy. And when he told Buddy that he'd given up his seat, Buddy was disappointed. And Buddy said to him, he says, "I hope you freeze your butt off in that bus tonight." And Waylon said, "I said something that kids say to each other at the time." And he says, "I'll regret the rest of my life." And he says, "Well, I hope your plane crashes."
Ah.
And Waylon became very emotional, very teary-eyed on the show, and said, "I have regretted that, the rest of my life."
I think so. I think he legitimately feels that way.
Oh, absolutely, absolutely.
You people joke about stuff like that, and these things happen.
The strange things, when you write a book like this, people come out of the woodwork, and some of them you roll your eyes, some of them it makes you wonder, and it makes you say, I was doing a book signing in Waterloo, Iowa, and large crowd, but there was a man in his, I'd say in his 70s, sitting in the front row, and he's acting in a way that no speaker ever wants to see. He's got his arms crossed, and he's frowning as I'm talking, and so I'm thinking, oh, this guy.
You can't reach that one.
yeah. And so we finished the book talk, and I asked three questions. Well, the first hand that goes up is his. And so I look at him, I say, what if he said, if Jerry Dwyer says he has that plane, he's a damn liar. And the crowd just went quiet because one of the things that has been just accepted, Buddy Holly lore, Jerry Dwyer says that he has the plane. He says that he has it. And he said he has it buried and hidden. And someday he's going to he's writing a book and he's going to dig up the plane and you know, present it to the world. Well, Jerry was still alive. I had talked to Beechcraft, the people who manufactured the plane, and they said that they, with new technology, they'd love to have the wreckage and take a, you know, relook at it. The NTSB said they'd love to have it. So I was challenging Jerry to give up the plane, and Jerry, you know, wouldn't give up the plane. Well, Jerry has since died, and there's still no plane. But he claimed he has it.
Where do you think it is?
Well, I know where it is. John Skipper, who was a veteran newsman for the Mason City Gazette, said that there was a reporter who was also a pilot, was out at the airport in the early 1980s, and he said there was a hangar, the door was open, it was Jerry's hangar, and he said you could see just the wings from the plane. He said it had the identifying number on it. He said it was tied to the back of a hangar, but there was nothing else. But there's this man who said that Jerry was a liar. I said, well, what makes you say that? And he says, when I was 18 years old, he says, my dad owned a dump truck, and he would advertise the dump truck for hire. And he said, about August of 1959, he said, Jerry Dwyer called him, and he said, I need you to bring the dump truck out to the airport, here's the hangar number, and come after dark. And he said, I'll have instructions for you. So he said, my dad took me along for the help. He said, we got there, and there was a forklift, and Jerry loaded this ball of aluminum. He said it was unrecognizable as an airplane. He said, but we later found out it was an airplane, onto the back of this dump truck. And he said, go to the Mason City dump. He said, they're waiting for you. They're going to open up for you. He said, they're going to show you where to put this garbage. He gave him 2 5-gallon pails of aviation fuel. He says, douse it with fuel and burn it. And he says, don't leave until fire goes out. He said, they're going to cover it up tomorrow. He said, so we took it out there. He said, I'm not thinking much about it. He said, but later on I realized, well, wait a minute, this is the airplane. Well, Jerry said he had it. Jerry said that he had kept it and so on and so forth. And later on we found, in my research, Jerry had, when there's a crash like this, the insurance company owns the wreckage.
They do. Not the NTSB.
No, the insurance company. And then they will... if there's anything salvageable, they'll sell off parts or whatever the case may be, which is a common thing. Well, Jerry bought it back and ended up selling off some of the avionics, the equipment that was still usable, off, and then he dumped it in the Mason City dump. And I had actually talked to some researchers and I said, hey, this would be an incredible find. Let's go dig up this airplane. Well, the dump in 1959 isn't where it is today. And today there is I understand there's an office complex built on top of it.
As morbid as it is, Gary, would anybody buy it for memorabilia?
Well, there's a museum owner and a collector, a very wealthy man in Rockford, Illinois, who I had spoke at his museum, and he said, you find that plane, he said, that's worth $1 million. He said, to me.
Easy, yeah.
Yeah.
So they would collect it.
Oh, absolutely.
Gary Moore with us. We're going to take calls with him next hour about this incredible case. Buddy Holly was already a star, right?
Oh, he was. I mean, a shooting star. I mean, his career was 18 months long, and the popularity and the versatility of his music was just amazing. I mean, rock stars, the young rock stars at the time, they would have a kind of a method of operation, and their music kind of followed a formula, and a lot of their songs ended up sounding alike. Buddy's songs were so different.
Yeah,
he
was a little like Roy Orbison.
Oh, yeah, very cut from the same cloth.
Yeah,
absolutely.
Same kind. And Ritchie Valens was just starting to take off.
Mm-hmm.
But the Bopper, wasn't he a radio DJ who started doing these events?
Yes, he was. And, he had written a song called Chantilly Lace, Chantilly which ended up being a gigantic hit. But part of it for kind of comedic value. I mean, the Big Bopper was a very, very funny guy. On stage, he was just hilarious. On the radio, he was hilarious. And so people didn't take him seriously as a musician. But when you look back at some of the songs that he wrote that most people don't realize, you know, that he had written them, you know, they were recorded by other people in big, big hits. So he really was a creative songwriter.
We'll be back with more in just a moment on Coast to Coast AM. We'll take your phone calls as we talk about the day the music died. I'm George Norrie, and we'll be back in a moment with Gary Moore. Don't forget to like us on Facebook, if you would. Follow us on Twitter, and send me an email at george@coasttocoastam.com.